Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Copernic Global Investors second quarter 2018 conference call. As a reminder, today's call is being recorded. At the conclusion of today's presentation, there will be a question and answer session. Instructions will be given at that time. At this time, I would like to turn the call over to Mr. Chris Lopez. Please go ahead, Mr. Lopez.
Thank you, operator. Hello and good afternoon, everyone. Thank you for joining us today for the second quarter 2018 conference call. My name is Chris Lopez, and I have with me David Ivan, our CIO and lead portfolio manager for the Copernic Global All Cap Strategy, and co-PM for the Copernic International Strategy. Before I pass the call over to Dave, I'd like to provide everyone with a quick firm update. From an overall AUM standpoint, the firm assets as of the end of the second quarter were right around $3.5 billion. This represents an impressive growth of roughly 24% over the last 12 months, where we saw roughly $345 million in net new assets. This was due to the firm being awarded new mandates across all channels, and also many existing clients that have been allocating more towards value and away from growth. Both strategies have continued to attract smart and like-minded long-term investors that realize the optionality and the tremendous opportunities our portfolios exhibit. We do believe it is the case given the steep discounts the portfolios are trading at today. Lastly, from a people standpoint, we're well-positioned with 38 people strong, and we appreciate the opportunity to serve you and your clients. Finally, Dave will be referring to the presentation that can be found on our website at copernicglobal.com. This can be found under the News and Views section. And with that, I'll turn the call over to Dave. Dave?
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Thanks, Chris, and thanks, everybody, for dialing in. It is certainly a timely time to be looking back at the markets. It's one of those extraordinary periods. It's amazing also how quickly 5 years have gone by as we've done Copernic. We think we launched it at a really opportune time. We think this because having value managers that have stuck with their style through all this is scarce, and we think perhaps very, very valuable right now. On the surface, however, it's been a very challenging time to venture into this field. Active management's been a tough place to be. Value management's been a very tough place to be. So before we get into the positives and why we feel good, let's quickly take a look. This is what's happened since we started Copernic. Value, judged by the index, has done three times as well as growth has done three times as well as value has. So it's been a very difficult time for value. And then, of course, that's growth. If you look at momentum, which, of course, is where everybody's headed, momentum has done six times better than value. And that's just using the NASDAQ as a proxy for momentum. We know the true momentum stocks have done much better than that. It's incredible how much the FANGs and the BATs have done. What are the statistics? The 10 of the stocks have been 120% of the gains of the whole market over the last year or so. It's really phenomenal. Looking at this chart, I remember when my first year in the business, you could buy every stock in the USA for somewhere around Google's valuation today. Pretty impressive times. Anyhow, we had at least 2016 looked like maybe things had turned. At least we all got a taste of what happens when momentum starts to pour back into value. But that was, of course, short-lived, and over the last year and a half, things have only gotten more pronounced. It's incredible how much growth is done relative to value in the last year and a half. And so far this year, it's reminiscent of late 99 and early 2000. Those were environments where not only was momentum the place to be, but if you ventured outside of momentum, you not only were left out of the party, you actually lost money. Remember back in 99, all profitable stocks in general went down, even as the market was going up big. And as this chart here shows, value stocks are actually going down this year, while, of course, the FANGs and a few others have led the market to gains. Most markets in the world are down pretty good this year, while the NASDAQ is up 13 to 14%. Looking a little deeper into this, we wrote about this in the commentary we sent out a couple weeks ago entitled Master and Servant. We were talking about how the prior commentary from January, February that we called Runaway Train, we were talking about how the momentum stocks were picking up speed more and more and was in danger of derailing. This shows figuratively how we are seeing a slow motion derailing one sector at a time, one country at a time. So out of 11 sectors in the market, 9 of them are being left far behind. And if somebody were to consider Amazon or Netflix to be more technology stocks than consumer, then consumer discretionary, instead of being up big, is actually down big. What a difference two stocks can make. So without those two stocks, 10 of 11 sectors are going down in an otherwise up market in the U.S. Not a healthy sign. And as money continues to pour out of funds that are being actively researched and into the mother of all momentum vehicles, the ETFs, we expect this kind of volatility will only pick up in the near term. So what does that mean for us? Well, we think that's a good time for those who are doing the research, because active management doesn't do so well when everybody's following the trend. But eventually active managers thrive when the markets are most inefficient and when the bifurcations are the biggest. We think that history will prove that 2018 is right there in line with 1929, 1972, and 1999 in terms of really standouts in terms of most inefficient markets and most bifurcated markets. We can say that in those other three time periods, one did not want to track the index when that ended. We think that's a similar time. So if people want to track the index, fine. But for those that don't, we think really the aberration here is the concept of whether people should use judgment or whether they should just track data. We hear more and more about people that are data dependent, but it seems like computers have allowed us to somewhat mindlessly pursue massive amounts of dubious points of data. And this leads to what we think is opportunity. Where they crunch the data, we say, where is the skepticism? It's one thing to find numbers on a screen. It's another to challenge those numbers, to analyze those numbers. We think that inquiring minds will want to know the answers to such questions is this a new paradigm? Is there such a thing as not only economies of scale, but its size? It's economies of scale when things get too big, too unwieldy. Can the return on capital perpetually not just exceed, but vastly exceed the cost of capital? Yeah. Have greed and fear been eliminated from the human genome? Do algorithms rein in emotions, or do they magnify it? How long can the price of assets exceed the values that support those? Can houses exceed rents? Can stocks go up without earnings go up and cash flow going up? Do wages at some point have to go up for people to afford these things? It's interesting, all the talk of the things and the bats, they're exciting because they're all starting to move into more and more fields and increasingly compete against each other. this happens. Can they all win? Certainly, they're priced to all win. Central banks, they're starting to pull back a little bit, but what have they done the last 10 years? Have they actually conjured wealth out of thin air, or are they merely increasing the supply of currency out there, effectively transferring wealth amongst constituencies? Yeah, well, we think it's helpful for people to know what they're buying before they put their money in. Now, don't get us wrong. We're not anti-technology. We actually love technology and are happy to be living in one of probably the best era ever in the history of mankind. Technology is a great thing, but we also believe there are two sides to every coin. Which leads us back to cyclicality and back to emotions. I think most of you have seen some form of this chart. As we look at this chart, you know, where are the fangs and the bats at this point? Have they reached the point of maximum euphoria, maximum financial risk? That's certainly the most euphoria I've experienced in 6 decades. And how about the different value sectors, some of which we'll come to? Yeah, it's been a long, drawn-out bear market for value. Are they now in the capitulation stage, despondency, depression? Maybe even we're getting to back to where there's a glimmer of hope. We'll get to that. But to the first point, as cycles go, you will not see a much longer and deeper cycle than this. It's been a long, painful time for value investing relative to growth. Either this time is different, and John Templeton has pointed out that this time is different are the four most dangerous words in the English language, or if this isn't different, this is the time to get pretty excited about value investing. We think the latter. We think things are encouraging. When it comes to value, or it comes to the concept of judgment and second-level thinking, we've noticed that just like we saw in 1999, many formerly value investors are redefining value. When it becomes painful to be a true value investor, in the late 90s, everybody rebranded themselves as GARP investors. Now we've noticed that most value investors have rebranded themselves quality franchise investors. At that point, somebody must ask, quality is good. Quality deserves a premium. But at some point, when the return on capital soars way above what it's been in the past for similar companies, is that sustainable? And when those returns have been augmented by massive increases in debt, is that sustainable? Is that a good thing? When it's been financially engineered, is that sustainable? At any rate, it's been 3 years since the Federal Reserve stopped pumping money, and now if Europe and Japan are serious about cutting back a little bit, we will find the answers to those questions soon enough. And outside of that, for people that are still true value investors, where's the value? Does scarcity still matter? If we've seen a rapid proliferation in financial assets, are they actually worth more? We see this happen even if we run into scarcity of certain commodities. We can have healthy debates on the true scarcity of real assets, but I don't think there's any debate on the plethora of financial assets. One would not expect to see real assets the cheapest that they've ever been, but maybe in the age of SpaceX, mankind has moved beyond the need for the Earth's resources. You know, we don't think this is the case. Furthermore, on the earlier concept, can you have the price of stocks go up way faster than earnings go up? Can you have the price of real estate go up way faster than rents go up? Can you have the cost of living go up faster than people's wages go up? Who's going to support these asset prices? We think with value, people need to look for the assets that have not already inflated beyond their fundamental underpinnings. So what's in scarce supply for sure now is common sense. But if common sense eventually returns, and it must, this shows where we are in the cycle. There is a time for active management. That time is after it's been out of favor. This is pretty long in the tooth, and the opportunities for active management get better and better as less people even try to ascertain where values are. So if people believe in passive investing, there are lots of wonderful opportunities. We don't need to discuss that. For people that still believe that analysis adds value, we will suggest that when active, stock-based, research-intensive management returns to favor, the further you are from the index, the safer you're going to be. We will point out that our three-year tracking error is 17. And not only is the tracking error high, and we're a lot different than the index, we don't do that just to be different. We do that because in a highly bifurcated market, we have an opportunity to buy what others aren't buying, and what other people are not buying right now is true growth. They're paying up for highly engineered growth in the U.S., but giving away true growth in the growing parts of the world, hence our overweight in emerging markets. They tend to not be paying up for scarcity, hence our opportunity to be buying natural resources around the world at very distressed prices. And we're able to do so by buying not the down-and-out devalued companies. We're talking market leaders in most of the fields we're in. So that highlights the opportunity, and that applies to both our international portfolio and our global all-cap portfolio. We don't do these just because it's exciting. As a matter of fact, that's not at all the reason we buy those areas. We buy them because the best areas are also the most attractively valued. To be buying global leaders across the world in a lot of industries that are here for the long run, you would expect to pay premium valuations, not some of the lowest valuations we've ever seen. 69% of book value, that's tangible book value, enough said. And you can see that most of the other valuations are pretty attractive, too. So, obviously, we're excited about that. Now, value over the centuries has tended to perform pretty well. When does it perform best? It performs best precisely when it has just finished performing the worst. This chart gives an idea of after 5 years of underperformance, how value stocks have done in the past. We will nominate now. It's one of the worst five-year periods for value investors. We think now is the time where people at least ought to consider having some value in their portfolio. And if we're wrong, if this still has more time to run and we have to wait for the value to play out, the upside is tremendous. We think the market is paying us for patience. If it takes a year, 2 years, 3 years, 5 or 6 years, the returns are likely to be very good, buying some really good companies at attractively valued prices. So with that, we're happy to entertain questions.
Thank you. To signal for a question, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. Also, if you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute button is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 at this time if you do have a question, and we'll pause to give everyone the opportunity to signal. We'll take our first question from Adele Gorilla with Zunis Investments. And caller, your line is open. Please check your mute button. We're unable to hear you.
Hi, Dave. Sorry about that. I was on mute. Hoping, Dave, that you... Yes, can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. Very good. Sorry about that. I was hoping that you could talk about tariff discussions and impact on the portfolio or any opportunities you're seeing because of it?
Certainly. Tariff is one of many highly controversial things that have been happening in over the last year or two. Usually the market reacts pretty poorly to unknown or disturbing events, but what we've seen is what I talked about earlier is a bifurcation. So we'll point out that we agree with most people that history and logic demonstrate that tariffs slow growth, tariffs increase inflation, tariffs increase uncertainty. But we are bottom-up investors, so we don't put a lot of faith in that, but we do take notice to what other people are doing about. It is interesting to see how the prospects of these sort of things have caused big discounts to intrinsic value in the emerging markets. Some of these markets have been clobbered, some are down 25, even 35% in the last couple of months. So we think even though tariffs are likely to be problematic, these have fallen way too much. And so that's given us opportunity to buy some really good companies at some cheap prices, many of which really aren't even exposed to tariffs. And then in the U.S., which is the source of a lot of the changes in the global paradigm, that seems to be the only market that doesn't care. So that market seems to go up almost every day, with the NASDAQ now up 13% to 14%, while other markets around the world are down big. So we think maybe caution's in order around the world. Maybe things should sell 2, 3, 4, 5% cheaper than they used to. Yet some markets are 35% cheaper and others are 13% more expensive. Bottom up, that's obviously leading us more outside of the U.S. and certainly into the growing parts of the world, and often with opportunities to buy companies that aren't even export-oriented. So we don't like uncertainty, but we do love volatility because it creates a chance to buy low and sell high.
Very good. Thanks.
And once again, it is star one if you do have a question. Moving on, we'll go to Anthony Eigler with Venture Pacific.
Hi, Dave. Just a quick question on some of these commodity prices. I know a year ago gold made its low in July. We're seeing that with copper as well, and copper tends to be, you know, more of an industrial metal, and you know, demand for copper long term. A combustible engine uses 56 pounds of copper. An electric car uses 156 pounds of copper, and if you look at the mandates in California with solar power and everything else. Just a quick comment on copper and commodities in general making some yearly lows here, and the thought pattern between, you know, the opportunity just becomes that much larger, you would think, when markets like this normalize a bit.
We certainly agree with that. We just like with the last question, there's more uncertainty and there's positives and there's negatives out there, but we've always agreed with Ben Graham's premise that in the short run, the market's a voting machine, and in the long run, it's a weighing machine. So let's start with gold. The gold price is going down. It's certainly people's vote. It's sentiment. It'll go down until it stops going down. Long run fundamentals will kick in. Has it been going down because the U.S. has erased the budget deficit? No. $1 trillion. If somebody had said $1 trillion deficits would be bad for gold, or though I laughed at them, certainly that's good for gold. Money supply last year worldwide, not in the U.S., was faster than any time in the history of mankind. That's certainly good for gold. as the price of gold down because somebody miraculously came up with a new technology that made it less expensive to mine gold. Nope, gold's more expensive to mine than ever, really. Is the price down because somebody stumbled onto a huge amount of gold? No. There's been almost no significant gold found in decades. And so the fundamentals don't argue for gold. Now to take gold and add copper and add natural gas and add uranium and add all kinds of things. The second part, the weighing machine, it's basic Econ 101. There is a price at which people will produce something and a price at which they'll demand, and as the price goes up, people demand less and people produce more. That works on lots of things, but it especially works in commodities. You saw when oil got to $140, everybody and their uncle went out and borrowed billions of dollars to look for oil. They found it. At the same time, everybody was getting rid of their big gas guzzlers, and then the price fell to 28. Now, at least in the States, everybody owns a pickup truck or an SUV, and no one cares about economy anymore. And yet people stopped looking for oil and gas. And so the price didn't stay at 28. It bounced back. And so that will happen. When the price of gold was 250, people weren't looking for it. When it was 1900, we saw a big increase of mining. Now nobody's building a major mine. That will normalize. The price of uranium, it was in the teens. Nobody was looking for it. When demand picked up a little bit, it caused the price to go to $137. $137, that caused Kazakhstan to bring up a tenfold increase in the production. Now the price of uranium's down to 23. At 23, nobody's building mines. People are shutting mines. Cameco shut the best mine in history. The Russians are not selling uranium anymore. The Department of Energy is not selling uranium anymore. Kazakhstan's cut back what they're selling, and Cameco's cut back what they're selling, just as the Japanese have brought a handful of plants back online, and the Chinese are having some success building there, the first few of 60 that they're building. So natural gas, uranium, gold are absolutely compelling. Outside of that, copper and others seem interesting, too. We think they are below the cost that would balance supply and demand. Copper's a little higher. Gold, we think, is 50% higher. Uranium, we think, is 3 times higher than it is now, plus or minus. So absolutely, in the long run, it is a wonderful thing that we are able to buy commodities at this price, but it's painful as they get a little cheaper each and every day. But for long run, for patient investors, we'll all look back on this very fondly, I think.
And as a final reminder, it is star one at this time if you do have a question. Again, we'll pause. And moving on, we'll go to Dan Gallagher with UBS.
Dave, could you discuss any kind of changes, any new additions or sales, or what, you know, what's happened in the portfolio in the last couple months?
Yes, certainly. Be happy to do that. I mentioned earlier we have a very different view on volatility than others. It's been 5-6 years where people haven't done a lot, and we haven't had to do a lot. What's been cheap is cheap, and what's expensive is expensive. Volatility a few times in the last 6 months has really picked up, and volatility, that's a chance to buy low and sell high. So what we saw a few years ago, let's take the gold space, was the really premium companies, the royalty to get cheap. That's a rare thing. We were able to buy that. So far this year, Royal Gold has been going up, but most other gold companies have gone down. But so we eliminated Royal Gold, and we reduced positions in other strong gold companies like Dundee Precious and Kinross and Lundin. And we were able to use that to buy Polyus, which is one of the bigger, more attractive mines in the world, and also a little one, International Tower Hill, and add the positions in New Gold and New Crest and Northern Dynasty, the other ones that have come back into range. We've within agriculture, it's interesting how a year or two ago people liked parts of the world but didn't like Brazil. This year they like Brazil better, and things like SLC Agricola run up to multiples of where we once owned it, and so that's gone. We've been able to add to Golden Agri, which is in Indonesia, trades in Singapore, and we were just having a discussion earlier on some of the ones we were able to sell or trim at a profit in the Ukraine have come back to values where maybe we'll be able to add to that. It's interesting, a few years ago Japan was not liked, and then earlier this year Japan was loved, and we were able to trade, trim various positions there. Then it started falling, but still Japan Steelworks was something we were able to trim a little bit of in the second quarter. Now Japan's corrected a bit, and so at some point it will be back in there. I think last quarter we talked about how we had trimmed Sberbank in Russia. This quarter we were able to buy it back at cheaper prices elsewhere. We were able to trim some Mitsui, which had done well in Japan. The telephone space we found interesting for the last couple of decades. And so a few years ago we were able to trim things like China Mobile. This last year we bought it back. KT in Korea is one where it went from 11 to 17. We trimmed, went back to 11, buy it back again. China Telecom has more recently become very cheap. There's a few other ones. But in general, it's been, I think, a number of years since we've been able to talk about this kind of activity in the portfolio. So absolutely, we're hoping volatility's maybe gone down a little bit, judging by the VIX, but certainly the fundamentals will dictate that we'll be seeing more volatility going forward. And as I mentioned, active managers like volatility and like bifurcation, and I think we will see much of that in the near term.
Thank you, Dave. Also, could you comment on the kind of the S&P put bet, or that cost of insurance, what we should think about that in terms of drag, in terms of the market just kind of grinds higher? I know that looked incredibly brilliant, and I don't know if you traded around that when that worked kind of well. I don't know if it was January, February when it corrected, but what does that do for us? How big a magnitude of a correction would it take for that to be additive?
Yeah, in the last couple of years, any flashes of brilliance have been short-lived for value investors, but we think there'll be more in the future. And as investors, so we appraise businesses and we buy stocks when they're too cheap, and those who have been invested with us for numbers of years have known that there's been times in the past where we've bought bonds or convertible bonds or and plays on commodities, and times way back where we wrote call options, so we're out to make money. We're looking for gross mispricings. We like to have 50 to 100 representations of mispricings in the portfolio, and we fully expect to be wrong on a third of them. It's interesting how often the ones we think we're going to be right on, we're wrong, and the ones we think we're going to be wrong on, we turn out right and pretty quickly and meaningfully. We can buy two or three utilities and want to go down, let the rest go up. Or a few years ago, we stubbed our toe on Peabody Coal and made a lot of money on our energy portfolio that year just because the other ones went up a lot. And so this falls right in that vein. We are prepared to lose a maximum of 1% every couple months, and we will keep doing that as long as the price we have to pay is obscenely low. And if you look at volatility over a number of decades, these prices are obscenely low. That's interesting to be able to pay an incredibly low price for a security that is intrinsically maybe more valuable than it's ever been. The put option, of course, makes money when the market falls. When will the market fall? Who knows? Will it fall again someday? Absolutely. Markets are cyclical. And how much and from where, we don't know. To your question, we've been able to buy these things at a low enough price that any 20 to 30% correction should make anywhere from 10 to 30 times our money on this thing. We would probably trim a bit along the way. And if it makes 20 times its money from the second we buy it, we made 20 times. Sometimes they drop in half before they go up 20 times, or we only make 10 times. So we have no idea whether this will be in the camp of the one-third of the things that we're wrong on, or whether it's just a matter of time before we're right. If and when it works, it will presumably pay off handsomely, and it'll do so fortuitously in a time where the market's otherwise going down, so we're not buying this as a hedge, but that's an advantage. So, lose a percent or make 10, 20, 30%, that's the proposition. And we hope that the implied volatility people make us pay will continue to stay low until this gets around to working, which should someday.
Thank you.
And next we'll go to Jerry Vandermeer with UBS Financial Services.
Yes, I had a question about China and the growth. If it's truly real, you know, cities built for nobody, as well as, and I know that would affect the commodities out there. And another question I had is, you know, some of the companies in the commodity area have taken on quite a bit of debt, and you don't want to get trapped in something that, you know, like a Peabody, that you get trapped in that because management basically got pushed around by a hedge fund manager or something. I don't exactly know what happened there. Just a question there. Thanks.
Sure. China is a fascinating place. I think, you know, with a lot of investments, we always try to keep in mind that there are two real sides to every story. I think in 1929 in the United States, people that said the U.S. had a good century ahead of it were proven right, and people that said there was too much debt in the system and there had to be a comeuppance were certainly right. And in 1989, when Japan was priced at the as if it was worth as much as the rest of the world put together, people that said that was too expensive were right, but people that said the Japanese should come from losing a war to dominating the automobile space for a long time, and for those of you old enough to remember, dominated the electronics. The U.S. right now is priced at over half the world. That's something that people should at least be factoring into what they want to pay for U.S. stocks. But more specific to China, I would suspect time will show that people that say 1.3 billion people that have a history of being good traders and smart people and are cranking out all kinds of great technology and working hard and quickly dominating the world at a lot of things, that means the next century could likely be a good place for China. I think that will likely be true. To your point, we are strong believers that you can't print money for nothing, and that the massive amount of money that China's printed since the financial crisis, the massive amount of debt and the amount of, and money is, I think, is a percent of the economy, three times what ours are, and whether that money was used to build cities to nowhere, we'll see the extent of that. And the fact that they did create a colossal bubble in commodities that took prices way too high 10 years ago, that's a fact, followed by a colossal bust in commodities, that happened. So those happened. So, people should not be buying commodities based on China's going to grow forever. That's what got them burned 10 years ago. China's doomed and will never do anything again. That's what gave us the opportunity to buy oil at 28 a few years ago, and possibly what's given us the opportunity to buy other commodities really cheap now. We prefer to bottom-up invest and find good companies. And 5-6 years ago, when they were giving away Japan, we'd say, yeah, we share the fear that they have too much debt and that's going to end badly, so we want a big discount. They gave us multiples of a big discount, and 3 years ago and a little bit again now, people said Russia's got a tough history and there's a lot of skirmishes and maybe that should be avoided. We said same thing, there's some real good companies, maybe we should want a really, really big discount to buy there. And people gave us just breathtaking discounts, and that worked out very well for the portfolio. China, like I say, we share the concerns, but what the A-share market dropped 20% in the last couple of months, some things a lot more than that. And so we really haven't been in China much, small railroad position and phone company. Now we're buying another phone company and we'll look at others. But we think China's got a very promising but volatile future ahead of it, and we want the big discounts and the market's starting to give them to us. You didn't ask, but same thing with Turkey. So that's the thing. We want a way bigger discount there than we want in China and Russia, but the market's starting to give it to it. Maybe you'll see some things there in the future. Time will tell. It's not whether things are good or bad. It's whether things are priced for worse than they are, or priced, say in the case of the NASDAQ, priced for better than they could ever possibly be. So that's our approach to China. It's a fascinating place.
Thanks.
And moving on, we'll go to Nam Nguyen with Battery Global Advisor.
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for taking the call. I'm just wondering if you can comment on Northern Dynasty Mineral. So I understand that, you know, the reserve is probably worth a lot of money, but what would happen to the stock if the company fails to obtain the permit to start the project? And then I guess the follow-up question could be, given the binary characteristic of the situation, what probability do you assign for that to happen?
Sorry to hear, it's Northern Dynasty you're talking about. Yeah, that
yes.
Comes back with what I'm talking about. Yeah, sort of like the option we talked about earlier, where what do you do with something that you might lose your money, but you might make 20 times your money? Northern Dynasties in that camp. We have lots and lots of resource-rich companies in gold and uranium and platinum and natural gas where we might lose our money, although we doubt it because the resources are so rich and most of them are priced even below liquidation value. We don't expect to lose money, but it could happen. Or maybe we make three times our money. So we have a lot of these that maybe we lose and maybe we make three times our money. And so all in a diversified portfolio, that works out pretty well. Now, after the recent drop, there's things that we think we made four or five times our money. And then Northern Dynasty, we think, is probably worth at least 30 times for it. So, in probably a lot more than that. And so there's all kinds of ways this can work out. Prices can stay down. And what happened a few years ago is they have to keep issuing shares. And maybe the pie gets divided in more parts and that hurts us, or you know, maybe they keep spending money on lawyers and that hurts us. And on the other hand, maybe you get things like we saw last year where another mining company came in and gave them a bunch of money just for the right to take a look and then walked away and left them with the money. You'll probably see more of that. And as you suggest, they have one of the biggest resources that anybody's aware about on this whole globe, and gold and copper also, incredible resource. And this is a business where, if you want to find gold and copper in other places, so often it means you're going way up in the Andy Mountains, or you're out in the Gobi Desert, or you're wandering around Western Africa, an island somewhere. It's a very, very difficult business. Yeah, this is in the United States. So that's a pretty amazing thing. This is a very, very, very valuable project with lots of obstacles. We don't expect a lot of good to happen in the near term, but huge upside. We're happy to have this as one small part of a very attractive and diversified portfolio.
Okay, got it. Thanks.
And there are no further questions. I'll turn it back to our presenters for any additional or closing comments.
Okay, and I just want to thank everybody for dialing in these particularly challenging but fascinating times, and I hope everybody has a good summer. Thank you.
And that does conclude today's conference. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation. You may now disconnect.